trying to see what the couple was staring at, but all that was visible were white clouds and an Esso billboard. "Put a tiger in your tank," the billboard tiger's profile said, facing to the left, urging those driving by to consume even more gasoline, his orange-striped tail jauntily raised to the sky. The clouds finally broke, and the moon came into view. There was just one moon, that familiar, yellow, solitary moon, the same moon that silently floated over fields of pampas grass, the moon that rose, a gleaming, round saucer, over the calm surface of lakes, that tranquilly beamed down on the rooftops of fast-asleep houses. The same moon that brought the high tide to shore, that softly shone on the fur of animals and enveloped and protected travelers at night. The moon that, as a crescent, shaved slivers from the soul, or as a new moon, silently bathed the earth in its own loneliness. That moon. The moon was fixed in the sky right above the Esso billboard, and there was no smaller, misshapen, greenish moon beside it. It was hanging there, taciturn, beholden to no one. Simultaneously, the two of them looked at the same scene. Wordlessly, Aomami clutched Tengo's hand. The feeling of an internal backflow had vanished.
"We're back in 1984,
Aomami told herself.
"This isn't 1Q84 anymore. This is the world of 1984. The world I came from. But is it? Could the world really go back so easily to what it was? Hadn't Leader, just before he died, asserted that there was no pathway back to the old world? Could this be another, altogether different place? Did we move from one world to yet another third world? Where the Esso Tiger shows us the left side of his face, not his right? Where new riddles and new rules await us? It might well be,"
Aomami thought.
"At least at this point I can't swear that it isn't. But there is one thing I can say for sure. No matter how you look at it, this isn't that world, with its two moons in the sky. And I am holding Tengo's hand. The two of us entered a dangerous place where logic had no purpose. And we managed to survive some terrible ordeals, found each other, and slipped away. Whether this place we've arrived in is the world we started out from, or a whole new world, what do I have to be afraid of? If there are new trials ahead for us, we just have to overcome them, like we've done before. That's all. But at least we're no longer alone."
Believing in what she needed to believe, she relaxed, leaning back against Tengo's large body. She pressed her ear against his chest and listened to his heartbeat, and gave herself up to his arms, just like a pea in a pod. "Where should we go now?" Tengo asked Aomami after some time had passed. They couldn't stay here forever, that much was clear. But there was no shoulder on the Metropolitan Expressway. The Ikejiri exit was relatively close, but even in a traffic jam like this, it was too dangerous for a pedestrian to walk through the backup of cars. They were certain, too, that holding out their thumbs to hitchhike wasn't likely to get them any rides. They could use the emergency phone to call for help from the Japan Highway Public Corporation, but then they would have to come up with a reasonable explanation for why they were stranded. Even if they were able to make it on foot to the Ikejiri exit, the toll collector would be sure to question them. Going back down the same stairs they had climbed up was out of the question.
"I don't know,"
Aomami said. She really had no idea what they should do, or where they should go. Once they had climbed the emergency stairway, her role was over. She was too drained to think or make a judgment call. There wasn't a drop left in her tank. She could only let some other power take over.
"O Lord in heaven, may thy name be praised in utmost purity forever and ever, and may thy kingdom come to us. Please forgive our many sins, and bestow thy blessings upon our humble pathways. Amen."
The prayer flowed out from her like a conditioned reflex. She didn't have to think about it. Each individual word had no meaning. The phrases were nothing more than sounds to her now. A list of signs and nothing more. Still, as she mechanically recited the prayer, a strange feeling came over her, something you might even call reverence. Something deep inside her struck a chord in her heart.
Despite all that happened, I never lost myself,
she thought.
Thank goodness I can be here as me, wherever here is. May thy kingdom come.
Ao Mami intoned once more, like she had done in elementary school before lunch so many years ago. Whatever that might mean, she wished it.
May thy kingdom come.
Tengo stroked her hair as if combing it. 10 minutes later, Tengo was able to flag down a passing taxi. At first, they couldn't believe their eyes. A single taxi, absent of any passengers, was slowly making its way along the traffic jam on the expressway. Tengo raised a skeptical hand. The back door swung open right away, and they climbed aboard quickly, hurriedly, afraid that this phantom would vanish. The young driver, wearing glasses, turned to face them.
Because of the traffic jam, I would like to get off at the Ikijiri exit coming up, if that's all right with you,
the driver asked. He had a rather high-pitched voice for a man, but it wasn't irritating.
That would be fine,
Ao Mami replied.
It's actually against the law to pick up passengers on the expressway.
Which law would that be?
Ao Mami asked. Her face, reflected in the rearview mirror, wore a slight frown. The driver couldn't come up with the name of the law that prohibits picking up passengers on highways. Plus, Ao Mami's face in the rearview mirror was starting to frighten him a little.
Well, whatever, the driver said, abandoning the topic. Anyway, where would you like to go?
You can let us off near Shibuya Station,
Ao Mami said.
I haven't set the meter, the driver said. I'll just charge you for the distance after we get off the expressway.
Why were you on the expressway with no passenger? Tengo asked him.
It's sort of a long story, the driver said, his voice etched with fatigue. Would you like to hear it?
I would,
Ao Mami said. Long and boring was fine by her. She wanted to hear people's stories in this new world. There might be new secrets there, new hints.
I picked up a fare, a middle-aged man, near Kinuta Park, and he asked me to take him near Aoyama Gakuin University. He wanted me to take the expressway since there would be too much traffic around Shibuya. At this point, there wasn't any bulletin about a traffic jam on the expressway. Traffic was supposed to be moving along just fine. So I did what he asked and got on the expressway at Yoga. But then there was an accident around Tani, apparently, and you can see the result. Once we were stuck, we couldn't even get to the Ikijiri exit to get off. Meanwhile, the passenger spied a friend of his. Around Komazawa, when we weren't moving an inch, there was a silver Mercedes coupe next to us that just happened to be driven by a woman who was a friend of his. They rolled down the windows and chatted, and she wound up inviting him to ride with her. The man apologized and asked if he could pay up and go over to her car. Letting a passenger out in the middle of a highway is unheard of, but since we actually weren't moving, I couldn't say no. So the man got into the Mercedes. He felt bad about it, so he added a little extra to what he paid to sweeten the deal. But still, it was annoying. I mean, I couldn't move at all. Anyway, bit by bit, I made my way here, nearly to the Ikejiri exit. And then I saw you raising your hand. Pretty hard to believe, don't you think?
I can believe it,
Ao Mami said concisely. That night, the two of them stayed in a high-rise hotel in Akasaka. They turned the lights out, undressed, got into bed, and held each other. There was a lot they needed to talk about, but that could wait till morning. They had other priorities. Without a word passing between them, they leisurely explored each other's bodies in the dark. With their fingers and palms, one by one, they checked where everything was, what they were shaped like. They felt excited, like little children on a treasure hunt in a secret room. Once they found each part, they kissed it with a seal of approval. After they had leisurely finished this process, Ao Mami held Tengo's hard penis in her hand, just like years before, when she had held his hand in the classroom after school. It felt harder than anything she had ever known, miraculously hard. Ao Mami spread her legs, moved close, and slowly inserted him inside of her. Straight in, deep inside. She closed her eyes in the darkness and gulped a deep and dark intake of breath. Then, ever so slowly, she exhaled.
Tango felt her hot breath on his chest.
I've always imagined being held by you like this,
Aomame said, whispering in his ear as she stopped moving. Having sex with me?
Yes.
Since you were 10, you've been imagining this, Tango asked. Aomame laughed.
No, that came when I was a little older.
I've been imagining the same thing.
Being inside me?
That's right, Tango said.
Is it like you imagined?
I still can't believe it's real, Tango admitted. I feel like I'm imagining things.
But this is real.
It feels too good to be real. In the darkness, Aomame smiled, and she kissed him. They explored each other's tongues.
My breasts are kind of small, don't you think?
Aomame said. They're just right, Tango said, cupping them.
You really think so?
Of course, he said. If they were any bigger, then it wouldn't be you.
Thank you,
Aomame said.
They're not just small,
she added.
But the right and left are also different sizes.
They're fine the way they are, Tango said. The right one's the right one, the left one's the left. No need to change a thing. Aomame pressed an ear against his chest.
I've been lonely for so long, and I've been hurt so deeply. If only I could have met you again a long time ago, then I wouldn't have had to take all these detours to get here.
Tango shook his head. I don't think so. This way is just fine. This is exactly the right time for both of us. Aomame started to cry. The tears she had been holding back spilled down her cheeks, and there was nothing she could do to stop them. Large teardrops fell audibly onto the sheets like rain. With Tango buried deep inside her, she trembled slightly as she went on crying. Tango put his arms around her and held her. He would be holding her close from now on, a thought that made him happier than he could imagine. We needed that much time, Tango said, to understand how lonely we really were.
Start moving,
Aomame breathed in his ear.
Take your time and do it slowly.
Tango did as he was told. He began pumping slowly, breathing quietly, listening to his heartbeat. Aomame clung to him like she was drowning. She gave up crying, gave up thinking, distanced herself from the past, from the future, and became one with his movements. Near dawn, they slipped on hotel bathrobes, stood next to the large window, and sipped the red wine they had ordered from room service. Aomame took just a token sip. They didn't need to sleep yet. From their room on the 17th floor, they could enjoy watching the moon to their heart's content. The clouds had drifted away, and nothing impeded their view. The dawn moon had moved quite a distance, though it still hovered just above the city skyline. The moon was an ashy white, and looked about ready to fall to earth, its job complete. At the front desk, Aomame had asked for a room high up with a view of the moon, even if it cost more.
That's the most important thing, having a nice view of the moon, she said.
The clerk was kind to this young couple who had shown up without a reservation. It also helped that the hotel wasn't busy. She felt kindly toward the couple from the moment she set eyes on them. She had the bellboy go up to look at the room to make sure it had the view they wanted, and only then handed Aomame the key to the junior suite. She gave them a special discount, too.
Is it a full moon or something tonight? The woman clerk asked Aomame, her interest aroused.
Over the year, she had heard every kind of demand, hope, and desire from guests you could imagine. But this was a first, having guests who were looking for a room with a good view of the moon.
No,
Aomame replied.
The moon's past full. It's about 2/3 full, but that doesn't matter, as long as we can see it.
You enjoy watching the moon, then?
It's important to us,
Aomame smiled.
More important than you can know.
Even as dawn approached, the number of moons didn't increase. It was just the same old familiar moon, the one and only satellite that has faithfully circled the Earth at the same speed from before human memory. As she stared at the moon, Aomame softly touched her abdomen, checking one more time that the little one was there, inside her.
She could swear her belly had grown from the night before.
I still don't know what sort of world this is,
she thought.
But whatever world we're in now, I'm sure this is where I will stay. Where we will stay. This world must have its own threats, its own dangers, must be filled with its own type of riddles and contradictions. We may have to travel down many dark paths, leading who knows where. But that's okay. It's not a problem. I'll just have to accept it. I'm not going anywhere. Come what may, this is where we'll remain. In this world with one moon. The three of us. Tengo and me, and the little one.
Put a tiger in your tank, the Esso tiger said, his left profile toward them. But either side was fine. That big grin of his facing Aomame was natural and warm.
I'm going to believe in that smile,
she told herself.
That's what's important here.
She did her own version of the tiger's smile, very naturally, very gently. She quietly stretched out a hand, and Tengo took it. The two of them stood there, side by side, as one, wordlessly watching the moon over the buildings, until the newly risen sun shone upon it, robbing it of its nighttime brilliance. Until it was nothing more than a gray paper moon, hanging in the sky.
This has been an Audible Inc. production of 1Q84, written by Haruki Murakami, narrated by Allison Hiroto, Mark Vitor, and Mark Boyette. Executive producer, Kristen Lang. Producer, Mike Charzik. Directed by Keith Reynolds. Music by Tom Pyle. Copyright, Haruki Murakami Books 1 and 2, 2009. Book 3, 2010. English translation copyright, Haruki Murakami 2011 Books 1 and 2, translated by J. Rubin. Book 3, translated by Philip Gabriel. Production copyright 2011 by Audible Inc.
And now, an Audible bonus interview with the 1Q84 translators, J. Rubin and Philip Gabriel. They were kind enough to find a few minutes in their busy schedule to speak via telephone about their experience working on 1Q84.
Can you start by telling us a bit about your backgrounds and how you got into translating books and Japanese books in particular?
Which one of us?
Jay, why don't you go first?
I guess I started earlier. I'm older. I was taking a course, an introductory course in Japanese literature at the University of Chicago, taught by Edwin McClellan. And it was all the readings were strictly in English, but he would bring a Japanese book every time into class and read some of the Japanese and explain to us what was going on in the original language. And he gave us all a sense that, or gave me a sense that I was missing an awful lot because it was not in English. I mean, because we were just reading in English, and if we could read the original, we'd see a whole lot more going on, or we'd enjoy it more or something. So I decided then and there that I was going to start studying the language. That was like the end of my second year of college. And started studying the language, and I've never stopped.
Phil, how about you?
Yeah, in my case, it's very similar. I was studying my final year in college. I was a Chinese major, and I did an independent study on Japanese literature and just chose maybe 10 or a dozen books and read in translation. And compared to the Chinese literature at that time, this was like in the early, mid-70s, the Japanese literature was just kind of blew me away, and I said, I've got to read this in the original someday. And fortunately, I got a chance to go live in Japan for a while and kind of study with tutors over there and, you know, started doing that and then got interested in translation there, specifically as something that I thought I could do, maybe the one thing I could do maybe better than a native speaker, because I knew I would never be a native speaker.
How does the translation process work? I guess we'll flip the order this time, so Phil, you can answer first.
Well, you get the manuscript sometimes. Usually you get it as a published book. Sometimes as galley proofs, which makes it a little trickier, because then you know that they might be changed later on. And I just set myself a goal of 4 pages a day. If I'm really up on things, I look up words and think about things for the following day, you know, to prepare. And just I do a rough draft when I'm finished, you know, with the whole book or the work. Then the process that I don't like very much, which is going back and checking everything for accuracy. And then the part that I do like, which is toward the end, which is just reading it all as an English manuscript and trying to improve the English. So that's the process that would work for any translation I work on.
And Jay, is it much the same for you?
Pretty much. Just get up every morning, go to the computer, and work until the brain fries.
Do you collaborate with the author as well?
Oh, I always write emails asking questions if I have a problem, or if I think, say in this particular book, there were an awful lot of passages that could have been translated into either first person or third person. And several of them I thought he should have a say as to which he preferred, and I never got a clear response. It was always do whatever works. So, I'm used to getting in touch with him via email in the course of doing the translation, and then send him the whole thing when I'm through. Sometimes he gets back to me, sometimes he doesn't.
So in this case where you were both working on the same book, albeit with separate narrative strands, were you exchanging notes with each other, or did you work separately and then just let the editor handle the merging?
Well, I'd say it was more of the latter. I mean, we had some emails between Jay and myself and a few on my side to the author. And generally, by the time it got to me, because I was working on the last third of the book, it seemed that a lot of things had already been decided. The editor often came to me and said, well, you know, this is how we've been doing it, and we think this works, and what do you think? And sometimes it was a different wording than I had. And, you know, we discussed it, and we went back and forth. And, you know, generally I thought, well, you know, unless I had a problem with it, which I didn't really, I went along with some of the changes. So, you know, I felt that this was kind of an interesting thing to do the last third of a book. I've never done anything like that before, where the expectations are that, you know, somebody else has already gotten the vocabulary sort of down, or there's been some agreement on it. So that was kind of interesting.
So I had assumed that, you know, one of you handled one of the two storylines and the other handled the other. That's not the case this time.
Oh, no. Knopf was interested in making sure that it didn't take another year and a half or 2 years for the book to come out. So
Right. Just
about the time that I was getting into book two, Phil was starting book three.
That's right, yeah.
So it had more to do with the length of the book.
Yeah, primarily that. It was just they knew from what Murakami had told them that it was going to be enormous.
Right. And
they made the decision early on that they'd like to speed things up. And
in order to do that, part of what they did with me was to send me the galley proofs rather than the printed book. I don't know if they did that with you.
Yeah, that's what I usually get the proofs before the book comes out.
That was sort of a first for me, and I thought, okay, this is fine. I can do this until the book comes out. And then I got the second galley proofs, and then the third, and then the fourth version of the galley proofs, all of them different. And I'm sure you're used to that, but that was kind of
I didn't have to go through that. I think the galleys that I get are much closer to the finished book. I don't think there were more than two little corrections that needed to be made.
Oh, really? Yeah.
So did you go through a process of translating and then have to go back to your translation and do changes?
Yeah, sort of. I had to make sure.
That's tough.
Of course, when the book itself came out, I wanted to make sure that I didn't have any of the things that had been changed that were in the galleys, you know, leak over into the translation. So it was a little bit different, but you got the feeling that, yeah, you know, they really wanted the book to be done, you know, in good speed.
Sure. The closest thing I've had to that was when I did, when I translated the Windupbird Chronicle.
Mm-hmm.
I started translating it while Murakami was still serializing book one in a magazine. So I started actually working from the magazine, and then after after that stage, he made a lot of changes for the book, and that was a real pain, having to go back and see where he had done major changes.
I wonder if he went ahead and made changes then when it came out in his collected works edition. I heard that.
I think there were a few changes, yeah, because of all the cuts that Knopf wanted made in the English version, then we left a lot of those up to him, and he chose a lot of things. And I think he decided, as he was doing some of those cuts, that improved the book, and so he introduced some of those cuts into the paperback version.
Huh.
It's really kind of crazy if you try to look for an authoritative text of the Windupper Chronicle; it would be impossible to pin down. I suspect that there's the original hardback, there's the paperback version, there's the complete works version. I'm sure they're all different.
Well, I remember one of the very first stories that I did, Barn Burning. I had it all done, and they said they wanted to publish it, and I said, great. And then Murakami got in touch with me, and he said, here's the new version of it. Base your translation on the new version. And I backed it to me at that time, and I started looking at it, and there was enough that was different. I really had to go through and, you know, line by line and make sure I was getting it.
Yeah.
But the changes were quite interesting. It was like the character had aged 10 years in actual time, like in real time between the two versions.
Really? Gee,
yeah.
No, I never really compared those two. That must be interesting.
Yeah.
Of course, you have the advantage there of that having been a story rather than a gigantic three-volume book.
Well, I can't imagine how painful it must have been to have to excise some chapters, whole chapters, right, from Windupper?
Oh, yeah, yeah. That was quite a process.
But you did that yourself, right? I mean, you didn't.
I did, only because I was trying to make sure that Knopf didn't just hand it to someone some editor without a vested interest in the book, and it would have been painful to see all kinds of things taken out that I didn't want taken out.
Right.
I kind of enjoyed the process, actually.
Guys, you mentioned that you had exchanged some emails with Murakami during the process. I know that he's done some translation himself from English to Japanese, but it also sounds like maybe he was kind of hands-off and let you do your thing here.
Yeah, he's done more than some translation. He's one of the major translators of American literature into Japanese. He could make a living as a translator. Just his translation output probably could have.
Yeah, when you go to Japan, they have his books that he's translated lined up with his books that he's written.
Yeah.
Because it's sort of like his name is on them, and that's what sells, you know, in large type. Yeah, he's translated just so much, and he's so knowledgeable about American literature. It's just amazing.
That's very interesting that it's sort of he's put his own stamp on his translations. Do you consider translation an artistic endeavor unto itself, or are you working more as a vehicle for the author's art?
Phil, I'll let you go with that.
Well, I mean, I like the idea of a craftsman maybe rather than an artist.
Good, yeah.
But you want to say that, you know, somebody like Jay said that we work every day a little bit at a time and try to polish something, but the original is not our own. Our job is to convey it as best we can to a non-Japanese speaking audience. And you know, I think somebody said one time that if they don't mention the translation in a review, then that means it was a good translation. In other words, they're not criticizing it or even noticing it, maybe. And that might be a good goal.
That's a great way of putting it.
Some listeners and readers of English language translations of Japanese literature feel there's something lost in translation. And you guys said you felt that with some of the books you read in college, and that's why, in large part, you got into translation. But there are others who feel that English language listeners and readers are just not familiar with the style of Japanese culture and literature, and that foreignness people feel is inherent in the flow of the culture of the literature, not the fault of the translation. What are your thoughts on this, and what do you do to ensure that nothing is lost in translation?
Well, I'll let Jay answer that.
I was afraid of that.
The ball's in your court.
I'm afraid it's people have all kinds of impressions about the original language when they're reading a translation, and they're almost always wrong. The fact is that the person who's reading a translation is reading the translation. He or she is reading the translator's words, and I've seen all kinds of ridiculous claims about how wonderfully close to the original something is made by someone who doesn't know the original and can't read the original. They just intuit that it must be. And this is absolutely pointless. It just, it's nice that people react to translated literature in different ways, but virtually anything said by people who don't have access to the original is baseless. Sorry.
It's a good response. What's the hardest part of translating Japanese to English?
Well, it depends on which author you're talking about. Some of them are easier to translate than others, for me at least. I think, first of all, just making sure that I'm getting it, that I'm understanding the original. Like I said, you know, we're translators, native speakers of English, but not native speakers of Japanese. And you can read something and feel that you understand it, and then when you go back and translate it, you suddenly all these things pop up that you have question marks about, and that you put question marks down that you're wondering about. Just the sense of, am I really getting it? Am I translating something straight that maybe is some subtle humor that I'm not getting? I want to, you know, that's why native speakers as helpers, you know, to ask them to help you out with this is really invaluable. You have to run it by native speakers, I think. I can't see doing, I made it sound as though I'm working in isolation, but you know, I'm surrounded by native speakers all day, and I grab people and just say, you know, could you read the sentence and give me your impression of it, things that I get stuck on. And then, of course, working with living authors, we do have an out. We can, you know, ask them, and we do ask them to help us interpret things sometimes. And, you know, they like I had a case once where I just couldn't find this word at all. I can't remember exactly what the word was. It was years ago, but it was you know, the author came back and said, oh, I just made that up. The neologism that I came up with. And I was tearing my hair out trying to find what this was. So, you know, occasionally you run into things like that.
When you translate, do you speak the words out loud sometimes to get a sense of the sound in English or Japanese?
I don't. Although I tell my students to do it, invariably the biggest problem in producing a finished translation is in the English rather than in the interpretation of the Japanese, and that's where you spend most of your time. Especially when I'd have students who were perfectly okay at getting the idea from the original, but simply hadn't had enough experience writing their own language to make it sound literary, I would strongly urge them to read their own text aloud or have someone read the text to them or read it into a recorder and then listen to what it sounded like. And that can be very helpful. I think I used to do that occasionally, that kind of thing. It's been years. The thing is, I'm a very bad reader. I sub-vocalize. You know, I'm kind of one of those readers whose lips move almost. And so I think that helps me as a translator. I can hear things without actually vocalizing.
I think for student translators, to have them read it aloud is a really good idea, because the mistake that they make is, you know, to be too literal. And if they read the English aloud, they'll realize that it needs to be rewritten.
Mm-hmm.
If it's too close to the original, they feel it's like holy writ or something. They have to stay so close to it. And
yeah.
I want to break them of that habit if possible. And I guess that's a good way of doing it.
Have either of you ever listened to one of your translations in audio?
I listened to a little bit of Kafka on the Shore. I mean, it's like, I don't know how many CDs. I played it for a class where we were reading that novel. And I hadn't realized that it was made in Britain, so I was kind of surprised to hear this, you know, these British voices, and listened to a little bit of it. It was kind of interesting. The students enjoyed it. I think they would probably have rather listened to that than maybe plow through the whole book. But but I think it must be quite an art, especially if you have different voices.
How would you consider the audiobook narrators who perform the work to be undertaking an act of translation themselves?
You got to have an awfully broad definition of translation in that case. Interpretation, maybe, kind of like a theater director deciding on where the emphasis goes or something of that sort. But that I wouldn't call that translation.
That's a fair answer.
Yeah, I would tend to agree.
How did you come to work on Murakami's books?
Well, I was introduced to his work back in 1986, just when I was leaving Japan to go to grad school. And I got a couple of copies of his short story collection. And I read those, and I just translated a few stories because I had this idea that I could be a translator. And I think I got credit for one of them. It was part of a paper or something, but didn't have any idea that they would be published. And then when I was in grad school, I got a call from a professor named Van Gessel, who was an advisor for a little literary magazine out in San Francisco, and he said they're looking for some stories by Murakami, and he'd heard that I'd had some. I don't know how he heard that, but anyway, so I sent some out, and they published one of them. That was in 1988.
And I think that made you the earliest published translator of Murakami.
It might be, yeah.
Yeah. As and, I recall. That wasn't that Zizova or something like that?
That was Zizova, yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, and they just actually did like an anniversary issue recently and asked me if I wanted to rewrite the translation, and I changed the first line because I always hated the first line that I had. This was, you know, one of these early translations that, like I was talking about being too literal, it was, when I looked at it, I winced a little bit, but I changed the first line and decided to leave the rest of it. They said it was kind of historical document or something.
Mm-hmm. The way it was. Which story was that?
That was Kangaroo Communique.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, I got this job teaching here in Arizona, University of Arizona, and I just thought, well, I heard that somebody else was doing the collection, which was, I guess, you and Alfred, collection of short stories. And I kind of gave up on that, and then I got a call out of the blue from The New Yorker, and that was the story I mentioned earlier, Barn Burning.
Mm-hmm.
And they said, oh, we have this, your translation, and we'd like to put it in. And I was, you know, ecstatic. I said, oh, that's great. And, you know, a few followed after that, and then had a chance to do the first novel which was South of the Border, West of the Sun. And then after that, I guess I was sort of in the regular lineup.
What about you, Jay?
I read the original of, the Japanese original of what later came out as Hardboiled Wonderland and the End of the World. And I read it for an American publisher who was considering a translation that had been sent to them, and they wanted an opinion on the book based on the original rather than based on the translation. So I agreed to do that somewhat reluctantly because I figured it was just another one of these pop novels that was out there somewhere. And I was really just amazed by the book. I just loved it. It's still my favorite Murakami book, that Hardboiled Wonderland, The End of the World. So I told the publisher, by all means, publish this thing. And if you don't like the translation that's been sent to you, if that's the reason that you're asking for this extra opinion, well, let me translate it. I'd love to translate this book. And they ignored me on both counts. They didn't publish it. And of course, my translating it became moot. I think that was about a year or so before Alfred's translation came out. Obviously, they had been considering Alfred's translation. But that was way back. I think that was back when the only thing of Murakami's readily available was the Wild Sheep Chase. Anyhow, that I just got so impressed by Murakami, I just started doing nothing but reading him, and I probably didn't read or teach anything but Murakami for another 10 or 15 years.
With Murakami in particular, some English listeners think the language divide actually adds to the surreal, sort of off-kilter world that Murakami creates. How does your translation affect that?
Well, but Murakami comes across, at least to me in Japanese, as more Americanized in a sense.
That's true.
Than other writers. I think you said this in some article, Jay, about when you're reading the original, getting the feeling that things have been occasionally in his mind, perhaps, translated from English back into Japanese. I get that feeling quite a bit.
And then the problem is, how do you get that back into English?
Yeah, exactly.
And you can't.
Yeah, because there's a sense of strangeness, perhaps, in the original Japanese, or that stops the reader, perhaps, in his tracks, and then to get that into English would be very difficult. There are many times when I come across the sentence where I think that's a very odd way of putting it. And then it just dawns on me that there's a perfectly good phrase in English that I think this came from. Does that make sense, Jay?
Sure. And then if as a translator, you decided you were going to give your English that same strangeness and purposely do a clumsy sentence or something
and
that sounded odd, the readers would jump on you and say, this is terrible.
Well, it would never get through. I mean, the editor would say,
Well, that's true. Yeah. So that's invariably lost, I think, going from Murakami's Americanized Japanese into American English, you sort of lose that strangeness.
Well, I translated one book. Actually, it was the first book I ever did by a guy named Shimada Masahiko.
Mm-hmm.
And the book itself had large chunks of English, just the way they were. You know, the characters were like speaking in English in New York City or someplace.
Mm-hmm.
And it was quite strange. You know, you'd have to turn the book sideways to read, you know, how they printed English sentences. But then when it came to translating it, I just kind of gave up. I said, you know, okay, we can italicize those and indicate that those are, you know, originally in English or something. But the effect is lost, really. The two languages, you know.
What have been your favorite works to translate, Murakami and otherwise? And can you tell us what you love about Murakami?
Well, Jay, you want
to? For me, it's the stories. I just think his stories are so weird and interesting and perfect in their completeness. My favorite works of his are the short pieces. Of all the novels, I'd say Hardboiled Wonderland and The End of the World, but I haven't had a chance to translate that one. But that's been done, so I think things like The Elephant Vanishes or the Second Bakery Attack, these are such absolutely great stories. Those are my favorite pieces, those kinds of things.
Yeah, I think for me too, it's some of the short works. They were the first things that I read of his, and what really attracted me to him. And you know, Barn Burning and some of the earlier ones like that. And working on those in sort of draft translations as a grad student, as I was saying, just learning about his language and his use of language. And for the longer works, I guess probably Kafka on the Shore, just because I lived with it for so long. And it really felt like it was a part of my daily life for so long. It was,
oh, God, yeah. It must have been.
A long story.
Literally.
What's that?
It must have been part of your life, literally. It was such a big book.
Well, yeah, it is. And, you know, it's another one of the two-volume novels and in Japanese and quite long. And
how long did it take to translate?
To do that one, well, all of these, I always asked for a year to do them. I think what happens is I ask for a year and then I try to get it done in about 10 or 11 months so that I give myself some leeway to really reread it and work on the English, polish it a little bit. I think with, and I can't even say this, I want to say Ichikyu Hachiyon, which is the Japanese title, 1Q84, it sounds strange to say that. I never think of the title in that way. With that one, I, you know, like I said, I got the sense that we really wanted to get this out in good time. And so I believe that one, I mean, I just did the one volume, Jay did two of them. And mine was like 600 pages in the original Japanese. And I think I did that in about 10 months, I believe.
I gave myself a year and a half to do the two volumes. And
I
was about a month under deadline.
Yeah.
It really just pretty much ate up that year and a half.
Yeah, it's even when you're not at your desk, you're kind of thinking about it, right?
Right.
Things
and the only reason I even agreed to do it that quickly, which for me that was quickly, was because I had retired and I didn't have faculty meetings to go to or papers to grade, so that I could pretty much do it full time. It took a year and a half for those two volumes.
Well, I just try to get up early before school sometime and get a little bit work done on it. You know, I think not necessarily the mind that is that fresh, I think, but that's where you find the time to work on it.
So. Sure.
One last question, Gus. Murakami makes a lot of references to classic and contemporary music. Does his knowledge of music affect his prose? Does it affect your translation?
The one time I consciously modeled something on a on some kind of music was Norwegian Wood. I just got the sense as I was working on that book that there was a lot of language that was very much like pop lyrics. So I consciously chose pop lyric type phrases very often, and gave that a little much of a. I tried to give some of that sense to it. Normally, I'm not even that conscious when I work on translation. I'm just doing what feels right. But that I really gave it a deliberate attempt to give it that sound. I have no idea if anyone can tell that or if it shows up. I remember.
Oh, I have to go back and look now. Yeah. Well, the what I tried a couple of times was to play the music that's being mentioned or talked about in the story as sort of background while I'm actually.